Hey, folks, welcome back to the podcast. If it's your first time checking it out, I'm Paul Mercurio. Before we get to my guest, a couple of things. Keep leaving those great comments on iTunes. We need more. We need to keep building that. So if you don't mind, please do it. I know I mentioned it a bunch. And if you haven't done it, do it. If you've done it, tell your friends. And also, please send links around and get your friends to subscribe to the podcast. We're trying to build this and possibly even, get this to spread to other platforms. So maybe even turn this into a TV show someday. So the only way to do that is to have a big following. So appreciate that. December 7th through the 10th, I'm going to be headlining at the Tampa Improv in Tampa, Florida. And December 14th to the 17th at the Omaha Funny Bone. So December 7th through the 10th in Tampa, December 14th to the 17th in Omaha. Come out, hang out, do a little comedy. I'll have presents for the holidays for everybody. I lie, but come out anyway. Had some bunch of relatives over for dinner the other night. Big mistake. Yeah. Well, all this family history you have with people, it's inevitable. Arguments start, you know, going back to 10, 15 years. Then somebody brought up politics and the whole thing just blew up. So I just started to try to avoid it, distract people from conversations like that. So like in the middle of dinner, I just screamed, I just saw the image of the Virgin Mary and the mashed potatoes. That got everybody's attention, had them bowing at the bowl. It was actually pretty cool. Then during the dinner, things got really heated and I just decided to check out. I did a face plant nap right into the appetizers. Yeah. It kind of sends a message, go home, but it didn't work. So after dinner, I created a distraction. I was kind of proud of this. I had everybody come out to the driveway and help me install new wiper blades. A really complicated task, you know? Yeah, that took about 6.5 hours. And then at that point, everybody was exhausted and went home. Oh, and by the way, you might have this guy. I have the crazy uncle who spouts off theories. Whether he's on the left or the right, it's irrelevant. Just, you know, this one that's just, he's just completely out of his mind. So you got to out-crazy the crazy. That's how you shut him down. Like, I'm like, we should invade the ocean. And then I'm like, all pigeons are illegal immigrants. Check their papers. Yeah, that set him back on his heels. My guest this week, Paul Reiser, great comedian, Emmy Award-winning actor, creator of Mad About You, has got a new show out called There's Johnny. It's set in 1972 behind the scenes at The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. Very, very cool show. Really well acted. Really smart, funny. And we also talk about, you know, Paul's history in comedy. He goes back. He's one of the big stars from the era with along with Jerry Seinfeld and Larry Miller and George Wallace and just Stephen Wright. Just a really great comic. And great conversation. So enjoy Paul Reiser. See you in Tampa, December 7th through the 10th, December 14th to the 17th. See you in Omaha. And please leave those comments on iTunes. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the show. Have a great comedian, actor, producer, someone who I've always been a very big fan of on the show with us, Paul Reiser. Welcome.
Thank you.
I like your first name. You got good taste.
You know what? I try to be more like you in every way.
Well, you need to curl up in a fetal position and cry. But before we get to the nuts and bolts of why we're talking, what cigars are we smoking these days?
Yeah, as I speak to you now, it's 8 a.m. so I'm not smoking anything. I am sitting here just trying to wake up, having some coffee that's bouncing off my system and not working.
Nice. Well, you have a great new show out called There's Johnny on Hulu, 7 episodes that just premiered. And it's really great. It's near and dear to my heart as a comedian and someone that grew up watching Carson. I just think it's really, really well done.
Thank you.
Yeah, there's so much great stuff in it. And I know you did The Tonight Show many, many, many times. Tell people what it's like that first time to do The Tonight Show as a comic, and what was it that sort of inspired you to do this particular show about the behind the scenes?
We all comics of our age, and I'm older than you, but I think even to yours, there was a certain standard set. Mm-hmm. Certainly in my day, like Johnny Carson was it. And you started out when I was 18 and I went on stage for the first time at a Tonight Show. I mean, on stage, in a comedy club. In the back of my mind, if I could even put words to it, was like, wow, someday I'll do this like those guys on the Tonight Show. That's the standard.
Yeah.
And as you start doing it and it starts to become a real goal, I remember thinking that was the only tangible objective that I had in mind.
Was it because in your mind it legitimized you?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
And it did. It legitimized you. You know, when you're a comic and you're starting out and you talk to somebody on a plane, oh, what do you do, young man? I'm a comedian.
Right.
The next question is, you ever been on The Tonight Show?
Right. Exactly.
Right. They didn't say, give me 5 minutes, or they didn't say, have you been on Merv?
Right.
Have you been on The Tonight Show? And
you can't, but you can't do that. Like, you can't go to a lawyer and go, I'm a lawyer. Are you a successful lawyer?
Yeah,
like,
have you been on the Supreme Court?
Yeah,
no,
exactly.
I never heard of you. But the funny thing was, even if you said, yeah, I was on The Tonight Show, then they look at it and go, well, I still never heard of you. But
yeah, now what you get is, yeah, well, you know, I don't stay up that late.
Yeah,
I DVR it.
Right,
that's what
right,
you get.
Right. But which is a funny thing, too, because this show that There's Johnny, we set in 1972.
Mm.
And at that time, they didn't even have video recorders. So
right.
You had to stay up. So even that concept is no longer a relevant thing.
Yeah.
People will say, you see so-and-so on Colbert, it's like, no, but I'll catch it later. I'll watch it in the back of the car on
the
phone.
Exactly, exactly.
You didn't have that option. So that's part of why Johnny Carson was so influential and so deep. You know, it was appointment television before we had that word.
Yeah.
You stayed up and you watched them. I remember as a kid, you know, staying up, and I wouldn't watch always the whole show, but I'd watch the monologue, and I'd stay up if George Carlin was on, if Robert Klein
was so
on.
Funny. I would ask my parents if I could watch the monologue, and then I'd ask if there was a comedian on, Rickles
right.
or whatever,
yeah,
and then
oh,
I would
sure.
go into school the next day, and I'd stand in the locker room, and I'd do, like, their bits, like, and I was getting laughs with their bits. I mean, I'd say, like, I saw Rodney, and then I'd start doing some Rodney jokes and stuff, and it was just... there was something about it. I just was drawn to it.
Yes, exactly the right word. We were all drawn to it. And I know, I don't think I had any really plans in my head, like, I'm going to do that. But you just, you know, just like you're a kid and you know, you play baseball and you try and be like the guys and, you know, you're around the bases like Mickey and you try and you know, hold the bat like this guy.
Yeah.
And you just, so you emulate them before you are thinking about career choices.
Yeah.
But so it was a big part of our lives. So,
and by the way, just for a second, our lives, I mean, you were part of a core of new generation of comics. I mean, you know, there was Carlin and then, and you know, there was Mort Saul and then there was Robert Klein and Pryor, but then there was you and Jerry Seinfeld and Larry Miller. And you all came out of the comic strip for the most part.
We all came out of, you know, the comedy clubs.
Yeah.
And the other guy, you know, those clubs, as we know them, were comedy little petri dishes where comics would go and try out. They didn't exist in Carlin's day. So, you know, they would go to little nightclubs or coffee houses. There wasn't a real comedy industry, and that started really in the early 70s.
Right.
So by the time when I was in college, and those clubs were forming. We've talked about this, you know, though you'd sit at home and you'd watch The Tonight Show and you'd see somebody and Johnny would say, yeah, and he's appearing at the Comedy Store. So like in your head, bing, okay, so if you go to that place,
right,
you end up on this place.
Right.
And so
right.
that's where we all went like little moths to the flame.
Yeah.
We all went to the comedy clubs figuring it'll work itself out. We'll figure out what to do once we get here.
Yeah.
And so, as I say, it was always The Tonight Show was the standard, and that was as far as you can see.
Mm.
And so now, all these years later, a buddy of mine, David Simon, not the David
that
Simon
jerk.
Who wrote The Wire.
Oh, that jerk.
Different guy.
No,
that's why he's called David Stephen Simon.
Ah, there you go.
His actual birth name was David Simon, comma, not that one. But his parents thought that would help. Years before The Wire was even made.
Yeah, exactly.
Not that one.
No.
But he's an old buddy of mine, and we've worked together, and periodically, you know, we'll just throw ideas around. And about 12, 13 years ago, we batted this idea, because we were talking about this, just very this, like how much we loved watching The Tonight Show and what appointment television it was, and how as a kid sitting in, you know, at home, you're going, oh, it doesn't, especially when Johnny moved to Burbank, which was in 72,
yeah,
it suddenly looked, It was in color, and
yeah.
it was like, oh, that's the coolest place to be, because it felt like Johnny was having you over to the house.
Right? Yeah,
there's the couch, there's the friends, the same people. It was a place to hang. So we were just saying, well, wouldn't that be a fun world to put a show in?
Mm-hmm.
And then we just threw the idea around. I thought, well, let's put a kid in there, like let's be, you know, the surrogate audience or us if a kid is wide eyed. And so we came up with the idea. This 19-year-old kid from Nebraska, he's just pure and sweet kid who's never been off the farm. And a story that we came up with was that he wanted a picture for his, an autographed picture for his parents, because his parents were going through some hard times and they loved Johnny, and Johnny was everything, especially if you're from Nebraska like Johnny.
Yeah.
And so they send him a picture and they put in a little form letter, you know, welcome to the Tonight Show family. Whenever you're here, you know, please stop by and say hello. And in his naive head, he goes, I got a job.
Johnny wants me to come and hang out.
Look, they just told me. And he gets himself to Burbank, and they look at him like, oh, you simple, simple child.
Yeah.
Like,
and his name is Andy Klavan.
Andy Klavan. Did you do something that people could Jerry Lewis it up?
Yeah, that was perfect. It's so
Andy Klavan.
Yeah, you die with the thing. And he's great. Ian, I think, is the actor's
Ian person. Nelson is this kid who is as sweet and as delightful as the character, and he, you know, and it just resonates. You see him and you just, oh, you don't, everybody wants to take care of them. You know,
yeah, exactly. And you know what's great about his character and the way you drew his character and the way he's acting that character is, it's, I don't want to say it's a blank slate, but it's a vessel through which you see everything else. It doesn't dominate the show, but
it
accentuates and helps that character, and I think also Joy Greenfield's character, which reminds me almost like of Mary Tyler Moore in her show, which was dominated by men in the newsroom. I felt like there was a bit of a parallel. And I think those two people you used to tell the story, and I think it's well executed.
No, thank you. Well, it's an interesting thing, because, you know, we talk about and promoting the show, and we talk about Johnny, and it is very much Johnny centric, but it's not about Johnny, and Johnny doesn't appear in the show. Well, we have clips, but it's really about these characters and those two, the Andy Klavan and this character Joy, played by Jane Levy, who is just exceptional.
Yeah,
and it's they're both coming of age. They both couldn't be more different. He's this farm kid who's never seen a woman as complicated as her, and she's looking at him like, I've never seen a guy who's actually honest.
Yeah.
He's not playing games.
Yeah.
I'm like, are you for real? You really are this sweet.
Yeah.
And she takes it upon herself to mold him. It's like, all right, I'm going to help you become, I think you might become one of the good ones.
Yeah.
I'm gonna help you. And don't become an asshole, because that's possible. I mean, actually, there's a great scene where she says, listen to me, and because it's, you're going to become an asshole unless you listen to me. And it's important that you follow my instructions. Right? And like, let me make the man that a 70s man should be.
And he's so wide-eyed that it's
And you know, he's a terrific actor and really hardworking, and I felt for him because he had, by definition, he had the least exciting role. He's the lead, and he's the conduit to the story, but he's the guy watching all this crazy stuff.
It's in some ways it reminded me of Jerry in Seinfeld, in that he kind of was
a little bit like
there was three crazies around him, and you couldn't have four crazies or it wouldn't work. Like,
well, there's always that person. It's sort of Judd Hirsch in Taxi.
Right.
You know, there's a guy who is the audience's surrogate, and then you need somebody who is the base.
Right.
And here, as you said, he's coming into this world and seeing it, and they're having fun with making him blush. It's like, you like the girl, you know, it's like.
Or the scene where she's on his lap and takes her time, like, just takes her time.
God. The scene where, like, oh, I guess this is what happens in California. Okay, women just start making out with you on the first day. How long has this been going on?
Why didn't I get out of here sooner?
Yes.
Hey, why did you decide to set it, two things, why did you decide it's 72 and you have action? What blew me away when I started watching the episodes is that you have actual footage of Johnny on the air. Did you get that from his estate?
We had this idea years ago, and as soon as we had the story, and we thought it'd be really great to actually show Johnny. And so we went to the Carson Company, and it's run by his all the television, all the archives are run by this fellow named Jeff Sotzing, who was actually Johnny's nephew. He's like in his 60s now. Mm-hmm. So we pitched him this story about the young kid, and he gets a job there, but nobody can touch him because he's from Nebraska and Johnny likes him. And Jeff said, well, you know, you just pitched my life story. I said, no, I don't know. He goes, yeah, my Uncle Johnny gave me a job after college, and I just was working for the summer answering phones. And then, I don't know, I stuck around. And then they said, go down to the basement and find something to do. Literally. And he couldn't, and every time he screwed up, people go, yeah, it's Johnny's nephew, leave him alone. And so they couldn't touch him. And he, ironically, he became the guy that is responsible for archiving and saving all the clips and putting them in, you know, so now you can look up any show from 1972 on. You can look up anything by any word, any guest. You can say any bikini jokes, and they all come up.
And, you know, it's, I think maybe this is maybe why 72, because when he moved from New York, they destroyed a lot of the tapes from before 72. Yeah. I don't know who, you know what, they're taking up too much room. We need more we need more room for the stacks of water and paper.
Well, so the reason that we put it in 72 was that's when he moved, and it seemed like the perfect time, because now even Johnny and the crew are on sort of shaky ground, right? They're kind of finding themselves.
Yeah.
Some New Yorkers are moving out to L.A., but it was also so, and that was when the show took off. I mean, 10 years is a long run, but still, 72 when they moved, it became much bigger. So their biggest years were 72 for like 10 years.
Yeah.
And into the mid 80s. But it was also a very interesting time to write, because it's Watergate, it's Vietnam, it's politics.
Yeah,
it's,
I wanted to mention.
Women's lib.
Yeah, you tackle pay inequality for women in it. You address racial profiling. I thought that was really great. Like, that was a conscious effort to kind of bring some of those issues out.
Yeah, and because especially, you know, here's this kid from Nebraska, and he's never met a black guy, and he's never met a gay person, and he's never met a woman who's as complicated. It's like, you know, and there was a line where she says, you know, this guy, the wardrobe guy, you know, just, you know, he's gay, right? And he said, oh, yeah, I'm fine. I'll be fine at this party. She said, I just didn't know if you'd be comfortable. He goes, oh, yeah, we. And then he goes, wait a second. And he said, you mean like the gay, like they're actually guys having sex with other guys?
Right.
He said, you know, we didn't have in Nebraska. That was.
Yeah, that I laughed out loud.
That hasn't come there yet.
Yeah. it just is. It's so great, because you can see it in his eyes that he's trying to be one way when he's really not that way. He's trying to act less innocent than he is.
And there's not a mean bone in his body. And he's so, you know, so all the writers are presumably sort of, you know, anti-Vietnam War and anti-Nixon. And yet this kid's got a brother who's serving in Vietnam. So like, well, I can't be anti. My brother is proudly serving. So like, oh.
Yeah, I was really impressed with that, too, that you sort of created that sort of awkwardness or that conflict between the characters on the show. And it just had layers that I didn't expect. I think the look is great. That I think it's great in 72 because you have those big wide collars and all. Like, it's so sick. And I thought Tony Danza.
How about that?
Man, I don't want to. He's always been a good actor, but. I had to look like, is he playing Freddie DeCordo? And he's so grounded, he's not overplaying it.
Yeah, he's great. Tony's one of these guys that, you know, when he first came on to the scene on Taxi, and he was just instantly likable. He's this good-looking, funny, you know, street guy that he's like, you want him to be your friend.
Right.
And over the years, he's just gotten better and better and better as an actor. So he takes all that personality and that charm. But he's built on top of that. So I knew Tony casually. We were friends, you know, how you doing? And it was a casting director's brilliant idea, because I had no idea. He's the only character that's an actual person in the show. And everyone else is made up, but we said, let's not play games. We know it's Freddie. Mm. And Freddie was this larger-than-life character.
Now, why did you decide to do that? Because you could have made up a Pat McCormick or some of the writers.
Well, actually had a Pat McCormick character in there that we had to... that we just didn't have room for it in the story, and there's not enough time. But we needed the Freddy character, so it was always based on Freddy. And then we say, well, legally, are we allowed to? Maybe we'll call him Teddy Spadorba. It's like, you know, like, what do we, you know, let's not be silly. Right. And it just, and it also just gives it an authenticity. But Freddy, Tony knew Freddy, and he knew he was this old school Hollywood guy, just always immaculately dressed, the blazer and the pocket square and the martini and the cigarette.
And for people watching the Tonight Show old episodes, when you see Johnny's got the guest to his right, but then a little left of the guest, you see him gazing. He's looking at Freddie.
Right, and Freddie's
sitting in a chair.
So America might not know his name, but you know, oh, that guy with the big glasses.
Right, and I was smoking a cigarette usually.
And so I remember the casting director, we just started, she says, what do you think of Tony Danza? I said, oh, that's brilliant. That's just brilliant.
Yeah.
And so thankfully, everybody came on board, because this was not the biggest budget show in the world. Mm. I mean, it looks fantastic. I can't believe how great it looks.
Yeah, it really does.
But, you know, we got all of our first choices. You don't think you're going to get them. Then
you have a name. I mean, you're a little mad about your show. Few people know about that.
That's very nice, but people have to, you know, I think what they...
You're known for quality, seriously.
Well, they came on board because, you know, we wrote characters that were fun and rich and complicated, and everybody just hits it out of the park. And we had four guys playing Johnny's writers, and we put it in a comedy room. That one was a little bit false because in fact the writer, there were more writers, and they would write by themselves in their own little offices.
Yeah, when I wrote on the Daily Show, we wrote in pairs. I shared an office with one guy.
Oh, okay.
And then we would write separately and submit separately, but we might help each other on a joke. But you're right, it wasn't like eight
guys
in a room.
Yeah. And I know on sitcoms there is a room, and there's just, you're just living there. You're just all breathing the same air, and
yeah,
you're just, you know,
like 30 Rock did that too.
Yeah, right. And yeah. So there's a yes, for sure. And there's a camaraderie and a competitiveness and a crankiness and a bond that form. So we thought that was fun. So these guys are all funny, and you know, you might not know them, but they're like each one of them funnier than the next. Mm. And they formed this very colorful group. Andrew Schultz plays this New York-y street guy who doesn't quite fit in L.A., and he's got his own demons to work out. Mm-hmm. And Nate Smith, who I work with in Red Oaks, came in. He plays the head writer, so as such, we gave him. He had to be the grown-up in the room, and his character is, you know, the one that filters everybody and brings the jokes and decides what jokes get sent to Johnny. Mm-hmm. And it was an impressive performance because this guy is powerfully funny. Nate Smith is so funny, but he sat on his hands and he said, "No, that's not. This guy isn't the guy who's going to go for the laugh. He's one of these guys. Like, he'll hear the joke and he'll go, good, funny, yeah,
right.
good,
right,
right." Those guys,
right.
And this guy, Daniel Strauss, and this fellow, David Hoffman, they play the writers who were always, and probably still today, are always on the edge of their seat. They don't know when they're going to get canned. And then Johnny's day was very clear. Please him. And every 13 weeks, their contracts were up. So if you had 2 or 3 days in a row where a joke of yours bombed, Johnny ain't getting fired.
Right. But what I love about the show is that you captured sort of the environment in front and behind the camera of the shows of that era, which were, it was a little bit more, like you said, it was like you're sort of hanging out with Johnny. Like I remember watching one time and Dean Martin was the lead guest and he came out. And then Dean slid over and George Gobel came out.
Yes.
And George would say, George was this, for people who don't know, this Midwestern type comic, very clean, little kind of nebbishy and lacking confidence. Mm-hmm. That was his character. And he would have jokes like, "Do you ever feel like a pair of brown shoes with a tuxedo?" That kind of thing. So he's talking to Johnny and they have it framed as a two shot. So it's him and Johnny. But this is when they would come out with either it was actually scotch or it was made to look like scotch. So they each have like a drink in their hand. Mm-hmm. And Dean, you'd see Dean's hand come into frame and he'd tap his cigarette ashes into George's drink
And George apparently didn't see it.
Right. So like literally 15 million people were in on a joke except for the guy who was the butt of the joke.
Right.
And it was... And then just the next 3 minutes were just brilliant, like Johnny trying not to give it away.
Right.
And I remember that vibe, and I felt like I really feel like you captured that kind of vibe with the show, which is not easy to do, and I think it's really well done.
No, thanks, man. It's a different world. You know, you forget, I don't know when it went away, but the idea of the one guest, when you finish, you slide over, and then now you're a little group. So you're three, and sometimes there would be conversation. And so now, you know, now shows, you come on, you do your thing, you get your laughs, you plug your project, you walk away.
Right.
And that's fine, too, because you don't really need to be sitting there for the next person, right? Just do your thing. But in the, like, for instance, the first episode of There's Johnny, I wanted a George Carlin clip just because I love George.
Yeah.
And we found, sorry, you can look in the archives and look them all up. And we found this one that was golden. It was exactly perfect for our story because George Carlin did his bit and he slides over.
Right.
And the next guest is this very conservative sex doctor who culturally is the other end of the spectrum. Mm. Right. Here's George, hippy dippy George. And there's this guy talking about too much perversion and promiscuity. And you can see the sparks start to fly, and the audience is going, oh, George ain't going to sit for this.
Yeah.
And they're egging him on. And then there's a shot, we left it in, where Johnny looks in the camera, just gives a little, like, how about this, folks? Ain't this great? Yeah. Like, because he knew these two were going to go head-to-head. Right. My favorite thing, and we had to circle back and make sure we put it in because it got cut a few times. When Johnny's talking to the sex doctor, and he says in all seriousness, he goes, well, all right, well, I didn't know we were going to getting into the subjects of fellatio and cunnilingus, but since we are, and your jaw drops, you go, did Johnny just say
right.
cunnilingus?
Yeah, I know.
And he actually says fellatio. He doesn't say fellatio. So you go, wow. And to a person, everybody sees it. They go, that's real. And I knew if we didn't show Johnny, you'd think we made it up.
Right.
And it's sort of like when you find out that your parents know dirty words. Like,
yeah, exactly.
Oh, really?
Exactly.
And I thought we made it up.
Exactly. And I'm watching that. I'm like, how did they get these clips? Like, it was so great because if you tried to recreate it, even with a...
we knew that wouldn't work. Johnny is... He was so more than almost anybody. He was such an icon. That image of Johnny in that TV frame, you know, in your living room is, you know, people feel it in their bones. It's like, oh, yeah, that's Johnny. And he was very much a part of your life.
Yeah.
And so to fake it is just going to be wrong for us. I mean, there are some shows you do it, and it's great. But so we knew from the beginning that we'd never wanted to see him. And my experience, well, I did the show a lot, and I never hung out with. I never saw him. He wasn't hanging in your dressing room. He was Johnny.
Right. He would come by before or after, right?
Not. I mean, Jay would always do it. I mean, once we were more peers, and that was Jay's style. He'd come in and and Conan and and Colbert. Those guys would come over and he'll say hello. That was Freddie DeCordova's job. Freddie would come in and give you things, but you didn't see Johnny till he got out there. Once Johnny came in and said hi to me, which was very thrilling.
Yeah.
But it was more a thing of he was in the air. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You sensed it. So when Johnny was making his move from dressing room to go to the makeup room, everybody had to go, just stay in the hall. Everybody stay in your room. And they're like, he didn't want. And it'd be like the president moving, the Secret Service. Like, hang on. And Johnny's moving.
There are dogs and helicopters.
Right. And they go, all right, you can come out now. And then you'd see Johnny rounding a corner and you'd see the back of his plaid jacket. So that was the vibe that I wanted to put in the show.
Yeah.
Of like, he's a presence, you know, he's there, but you ain't hanging around with him.
Yeah.
So we doubled him. We see him in the background. You see a blurry Johnny. And, have you gotten to the last episode?
No, I haven't gotten there yet. I'm on six right now.
All right. So you got one more.
Yeah.
So, well, there's some cool stuff in the last one that, we were just really not only the beneficiaries of some really good will, but some really good luck. And our last, the season, the whole first season builds towards the taping of the anniversary show. And the anniversary show was the 10th anniversary when they found out they didn't have clips, so they had to put on some other, they tried to make a big special event out of it. It was a really awkward, not great show.
Right.
They had like too many comics. They had Jerry Lewis and Jack Benny. So we basically explored that. What was it like when they put on a show that they have such hopes for? And I go, ooh, this is really sucks tonight.
Yeah.
This is not. And anyway, at the end of the show in 1972, there was a party afterwards that NBC threw Johnny a big 10th anniversary party. And they went to the Beverly Hills Hotel and all the big stars were there. And they sent a couple of cameras to just record it just for their private purposes. Well, there is now footage. So Joanna Carson, Johnny's ex-wife, gave us that tape. So we have, she said, she trusted us that here you go. So we have footage of the party that our characters went to in
the actual party.
We have pictures.
Wow.
We have Johnny making a speech. And like, so it's not on the air. This is not a Tonight Show. This is Johnny talking to this room of friends and big shots. And then we cut to the back and there's our characters listening.
Yeah.
And so it just, there's an authentic feel to it that we are really delighted.
Well, that's what happens. And I just, it's weird because I felt like, but you know, obviously this is my life and the I share the passion, but I think this is going to be the case for anybody who sees it. I ended up binge watching. I ended up being late for something because I couldn't. I really felt like you, it's almost documentary-like in a way, and I don't know if that's intentional,
I mean that
as a compliment.
It's all, you know, it's all fictitious, and it's stories, and,
yeah.
But there was something...
But the way you tell the story feels, I felt like I was there, like I felt like I was transported, and I was almost there, I was there in the hallway, like that's
it's, you know, we had great directors, and David Gordon Green, was a great director, was directed to the first two and produced it with us, also, you know, part of the trick was to put the clips that we use in the story. So it's not just we're going to stop our show for 20 seconds to show you an old footage, but it's part of the story. There is this authenticity to it. But to me, it's like, ultimately, you can't sustain a long series if you're just going to show Johnny clips. Because if you just go rent the Johnny, DVDs.
Or buy the ones that are sold on late night TV.
Yeah.
Do you have plans going forward, you know, you shoot more episodes to, you know, Larry Sanders' show, there was an exploration and you learned, obviously you knew the characters on the show, but there was, you know, the guests that would come on the show and then the dynamic of that and their interplay with people on the show. Do you see yourself doing more of that as the show moves forward, expanding beyond the core characters on the show?
I think you run into the same tricky thing. If you're going to have a Sammy Davis and then you cut from a real Sammy Davis.
Era, right. It's not so, present day like Larry.
So like we had George Carlin on the show on the clip and then you see him in the background. We had a blurry guy so we could show that he was there.
Right.
But you don't want to actually have a scene with a guy with a fake beard. You know,
right.
So,
right,
I think you can't go that way with the actual guests. And in fact, I didn't want to, somebody said, why don't you, you know, write yourself a part on it? I thought, well, no, it's because it's confusing.
Mm.
In 1972, you can say, I'm there as a, you know, I was actually on the show, but in 82. So it's now.
Yeah. And you couldn't, you couldn't play yourself now. You didn't age well.
Believe me. I'm well aware. So we made a point of not really wanting to have anybody who would have been on that show in real life.
Yeah.
Other than Tony.
Yeah. No, it's really great. If you have not seen it, you all have to see it. It's 7 episodes. You'll just carve a few hours out because you're going to watch one and let it flip right into the next one. It's really great.
And, thank you, man.
And all the acting is terrific and the casting is really great. Soup to nuts. And, you know, as somebody who's like a massive fan of yours and of that era and that show and Johnny, I hope it. I like it because there's a generation of people that know nothing about that show.
Exactly.
And I think that this is so hip and cool the way it's done and so well done, soup to nuts, that I think a 22, 23-year-old who's like maybe heard of Johnny Carson and that's about it, and knows your work from Mad About You but doesn't know your work as a comedian, maybe. I really hope it sort of spreads like wildfire, you know?
Well, thank you. That's the hope. And it's an interesting thing. The trick is to make, I think this really does appeal to a wide range of audience, but I want to make sure that they don't get turned off for the wrong reasons.
I think you made it relatable. I mean, you have a 19-year-old, have it relatable, but it didn't feel like okay, we have to have a millennial so that we can get the millennial.
No, it's about
demo.
A kid, and it was, and these are the young people who are in the story, and there's grown-up characters. So, so part of the thrill for me is that if you're 22 and you really don't know Johnny Carson, when you watch our show, you'll leave knowing something about Johnny. But that's not the goal. You know, it's not homework. It's not, this is not an exercise.
Right.
You know, as I was saying before, to make a show last, it can't just be about, there's 2 minutes of Johnny Carson clips. Any show, you need to have characters that you care about. And I think, we have these great actors.
And complicated, too. You made them complicated, which is what life is. You know, none of them feel one-dimensional, you know?
Yeah, and if you watch it straight through, by the end of 7 episodes, they've all come to a different place, and life has sort of changed for all of them.
I'm seeing it. I mean, I've got one more to go, but you see like that relationship between this kid and then the writer's room, and the writers are kind of jaded, but then they start to see things through his eyes a little bit, and especially the Vietnam War issue. It's just, it's just it's not just a clip show of like, hey, we're going to.
No, not at all.
Yeah, no.
Well, thank you, man.
Yeah.
And go door to door and let's get people watching.
Yeah, we're going to
get Hulu.
We're
That's the only thing. You can't watch it not on Hulu.
You got to get it. You get it on Hulu. I as soon as I'm done here, I have a sandwich board. I'm going to be standing on the street corner, 57th and 10th. It says, "There's Johnny with your adorable face on it." And please help this poor man. It's going to say underneath. It's on Hulu. Get Hulu if you don't have it. It's There's Johnny, creator, executive producer, comedian. What's your name? Oh, Paul Reiser. It's great to have you on again. And when you come to New York, let's get together and have a cigar.
Done.
Or
you're
LA.
On. All right. Thank you, Paul. Nice to talk to you.
All right, buddy. Take care. Thank you. All right. There you go. Paul Reiser. Funny. The guy's funny when he's not even trying to be funny. Great show. Check it out. There's Johnny on Hulu. And December 7th through the 10th, I'm at the Tampa Improv, December 14th to the 17th, the Omaha Funny Bone. Come on out. Please keep leaving those comments, and we will see you next week.